Welcome to the Cascadian Prophets Podcast, a production of the Cascadia Poetics Lab, empowering people to practice poetry and deepen connections to place, self, and the present moment.
Dancing with the Dead, Red Pine, and the Art of Translation is a film by Ward Serrell that will be screened April 21st at 2 p.m. at CIF Cinema Egyptian in Seattle. The film chronicles the life and poetry translation career of longtime Port Townsend, Washington resident Bill Porter, a.k.a. Red Pine, and tracks his path from son of a bank robber to American translator teaching contemporary Chinese about their own history. Red Pine is the pen name of Bill Porter, who worked at English language radio stations in Taiwan and Hong Kong, interviewing local dignitaries and producing more than 1,000 programs about his travels in China. His translations have been honored with 2 NEA fellowships, a Penn Translation Prize, and a Guggenheim Fellowship to support work on a book based on a pilgrimage to the graves and homes of China's greatest poets of the past. The effort resulted in the book Finding Them Gone in 2016. And we talked to Bill via Zoom. Bill, thank you for your time today.
No problem. I got lots of that.
Well, what's it like having a movie done about you? You're a historical figure.
Well, I think anybody would have the same reaction as like, why me? Anyway, these were nice people who live here in Port Townsend, and they did a documentary about some local people called, the film is called The Bowmakers. There's a number of people in Port Townsend who are world-famous makers of the bows used in cellos and violas and violins. And I saw their premiere and I said, well, okay, if you want to do one, go ahead. So, I mean, you know, I like to encourage artists. I guess I could be the canvas. Why not?
That's how they approached you. They said, hey, we did this movie about bows and we're ready for our next blockbuster. So let's give you.
That's exactly what they said.
Well, they knew you from town because they live in Port Townsend.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So anyway, the producer was Rocky Friedman, who ran the local Rose Theater for many years until just recently. So I knew him quite well. And Ward Serrell, too, a local filmmaker. I hadn't seen much of his work, but I saw The Bowmakers and I thought he did a fine job. And anyway, like I said, why not? What else am I doing?
Does Ward live on your daily walking route?
Oh, no. He lives about a mile from where I walk. It's not a long distance, but it's not on my route.
What was it like working with him?
It was fun. It was good. He knew what he was doing. I've never been filmed like that before. So you have to sort of accept moving the camera around and changing the setting. It took me, after he did this couple of interviews in my house, it took me a year to rearrange, to get my books and everything back to where they were, because, you know, he brought in somebody who does sets, you know, and my room didn't look exactly like they wanted to film it. So there's sort of weird things like that, but they were really good about it. I mean, they knew what they were doing. They had a look in mind, and they prominently displayed a bottle of whiskey of mine, so they didn't want the viewers to miss out on that.
Wanted to make sure not only are you a holy person, but you like a good drink now and then.
Good, yes. It's getting harder to find anything I can afford anymore, though. Seems like everybody else has discovered good whiskey.
And bourbon. You used to get bourbon, good bourbon from Tennessee or Kentucky really cheap, and now the Japanese have discovered it, and it's driven prices up.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a never-ending quest for that reasonably priced, you know, under $100, between $50 and $100 bottle of good whiskey that you can sip. I mean, I don't drink whiskey. I just put, you know, wet my tongue and my lips a little bit. That's all.
Albert Collins said, I'm not drunk, I'm just drinking.
I actually don't drink. I'm just sipping.
There you go. Tell us about Buddhism. What is it about Buddhist thinking that you find inspiring? You talk about in the movie about how you discovered Buddhism. And so, you know, people can go to the movie for that whole story. But tell us about Buddhism itself. What's the logic in it for you?
Well, the fact is there's There's no logic. It's a spiritual path devoid of thinking, and it's just all about yourself. You know, it's something that you have to re-examine the world you live in and yourself too, and see whether you can find anything real. And of course, you can't. But that's a liberating feeling. It definitely lightens your baggage. It's definitely you're definitely traveling light when you practice Buddhism.
Can you give us an example of that, what you mean by that?
Well, ideas, beliefs in things that aren't real, that are just social conventions, or even just perhaps the current thinking in on a certain subject. Just like we think of the world as made of a table of elements. You know, there's hydrogen, oxygen, and of course, everything's made up of this stuff, and that's everything that's real. If it ain't made up of that, it's just all hogwash. But anyway, it's just a different way of looking at things. But the nice thing and what attracted me about Buddhism is its emphasis on compassion. That is, it takes away the boundary between ourselves and others. There is no such difference. I mean, this you and me, I'm a fiction, and so are you. And it makes for a more compassionate relationship with everybody you meet in life.
So, in your example about the periodic table of the elements, the Buddhist perspective might be that's a delusion that everybody has to look at the world through that lens, and delusions are inexhaustible. But as a Buddhist, you vow to end them. Would you say that's an accurate application of Buddhist teaching?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, but of course, you never do end the delusions. There's like clouds. They just keep rising every day. What's the Buddhists try to do is end the attachment to the delusions that get you in all kinds of trouble.
Right. Did you ever expect that your work would become so popular in China and that Chinese people would learn about their own history through your work, the work of an American?
No, of course not. I didn't think my work would be very popular in America either. In fact, it still isn't, if my royalties statements are any reflection. But no, that was a big, quite the surprise. I mean, it's a pleasant and curious surprise to know that the Chinese had, just like we sometimes ignore our surroundings, we just get so used to them, and the Chinese had just ignore. And partly because of political repression, they had ignored a lot of their older traditions because they weren't popular with the Communist Party anymore. You know, they were backward. Anyway, I had the field to myself, you might say, for people following a spiritual path in China, and I just sort of stumbled into it, and having met these people practicing in the mountains, I thought I should write a book about it. I had no intention on doing it, but I took a year off from this radio station where I worked and wrote this book. It never sold in America, and the first printing in China never sold either until maybe about 7 or 8 years after the first edition. I remember I handed the well, I finished the manuscript in '93, and it just happened Gary Snyder was in Taipei, and I gave him the manuscript, him and his wife Carol Coda. He showed it to his publisher, Jack Shoemaker, who agreed to publish it. And eventually, his deputy publisher, Tom Christensen, published it with Mercury House. But like I said, it never made much of an impact in America. So I'm not I wasn't surprised with that, not at all. But it sold over 2 million copies now in China. And the other two books I wrote about my travels, visiting the graves of the poets and pouring whiskey on their graves, that's now sold over 1 million. And the Communist Party actually invited me to Beijing last June and gave me the highest award they give to foreign writers last June because they had read Finding Them Gone and thought, wow, for a Westerner to do something like this, they thought that was impressive that a Westerner would care that much about their culture and sort of inspired them to maybe reassess their own attitude towards it.
You think that's happened?
Oh yeah. Oh God, yes, yeah. I was in Shanghai last year and I was giving a talk and there was this guy at the back of the hall who raised his hand and said, I've interrupted my bicycle trip. I'm taking a bicycle visiting all the places you visited on your travels, over 3,000 miles worth, because he was doing it on bicycle. Visiting, also revisiting all the graves that I had visited, and where I had poured, some really nice whiskey on their graves, whiskey that would cost a couple $1,000 a bottle now. Anyway, people are retracing my roots, both in the mountains and among the literary figures of the past, and because I guess they've never thought about being a pilgrim, and that's sort of what I who I am. I'm a natural pilgrim. If you give me a, purpose, I love to go on a trek.
Some of the hermits were familiar with your book and only met with you because of the fact of who you were.
Yeah, it is sort of ridiculous, and funny. But it's true. Most of the hermits have copies of my book, or the hermit next door has a copy, and they've heard about it. So it's become quite the sensation in China, but it hasn't really changed the practice in the mountain. But I know that since I did that book in 89 and 90 was when I did my interviews in the mountains, but the hermit population has tripled in that same area. There are three times more hermits now than there were, and they're different. The hermits I interviewed were devotees, I could say. Now you get people with PhDs who've been professors, retired professionals, people with quite a high level of education becoming hermits. But it's, I'd have to remind people when I say this that you don't just become a hermit. It's the hermit tradition in China is spiritual graduate school. You don't want to try it without an undergraduate degree because you won't make it past the first winter. It gets cold, you get hungry, you get sick, you're out of there. It's for people who already have a certain level of spiritual practice that they want to go a bit further. They want to find their own voice. They don't want to just answer questions based upon what something in a book or something that a teacher told them. They want to come up with their own answers.
How do they get food? How do they sustain themselves when they live in a cave in the mountains like that?
They grow about 80% of what they need. There's a couple things they need from the flatlands, like salt. Definitely need salt. If you're going to get through the winter, you've got to have salt. They need cooking oil, and they need a staple, rice in southern China and wheat flour in the north. So I figured it out once, and it came to about $10 a month they need from the outside world. And they usually have a friend, a relative, and even the local villagers. If you're a hermit on a mountain in China, the local villagers are really glad that you're there. It encourages the gods to make it rain on time. So they'll never help you your first winter though. But once you've gotten through that first winter, the farmers are really happy that you're up there, and they'll come up to check in on you. And also sometimes just for some spiritual solace, and people from the city can do that too. So after a while, these hermits attract small groups of disciples, you could say, or supporters. So it doesn't take a lot to get $10 a month. And now they used to need kerosene for lamps, but they don't need that anymore. Now they have solar panels.
They've upgraded. That's fantastic.
Yes, they have. They're not fools. Lugging a 5, 10 gallon jug of kerosene up the mountain is no fun.
Plus, they can lower their carbon footprint.
Oh, I'm sure that was on their minds.
The Communist Party, as you were saying, swept all of the old traditions out, but now, obviously, by honoring you, sees the wisdom of that old tradition. And I'm wondering that here in the United States and Canada, in North America, we have other pressures, the pressures of capitalism and this culture of endless distraction with social media and sports betting and all the other dopamine culture types activities that we have. We have our own troubles connecting with real culture and wisdom traditions. So, do you see a parallel thing happening on this continent where those old spiritual ways are slipping away and being practiced by fewer?
You know, I live in a small town that's a peninsula, sort of cut off from most of the real world. So I don't really know what's going on in America, but my casual interactions when I do travel around a bit is that the roots of spiritual traditions in America aren't very deep. I realized that the first Westerners to come to China, to America were pilgrims of various kinds, people following different spiritual paths, but they were the people also who couldn't get along with the people in Europe. Oh, I mean, they tend to be extremists in their in their in their and they were extremists in their practices. And so I don't know. Just my casual view is that the spiritual traditions in America are not exactly flourishing. I mean, there are practitioners, of course, in all traditions, but it's just. And as you say, there's just the materialism and distractions are so overwhelming. It's hard for anybody to even want to follow a path like that. And there's all kinds of landmines along the way that blow your life apart. Whereas the thing about it is our roots are not very deep here in America. But see, the spiritual roots of China are 3,000 or 4,000 years old. They've been following these same traditions for that long, whereas us, we're just sort of getting started.
Except, of course, for the indigenous people, and we've done our best to try and eliminate every last
Oh,
one of those
yeah, of
people.
course.
What's the closest thing to a hermit monk on this continent?
I don't know. See, the thing about hermits in China, when I use the word hermit, I don't know what other word to use. But this tradition is not about going into the mountains and staying in the mountains. It's the PhD. Almost all hermits come down the mountain within 3 to 5 years with their self-awarded degree. Maybe 5% stay in the mountains. So they're not misanthropes. The Chinese hermit tradition is just the opposite. They're people who want to achieve something so they can help others. And so they're not, and when you meet them in the mountains, they're the most friendliest, most welcoming people you've ever met. And of course, you would be too if you were a hermit and somebody showed up. They're different from our idea of a hermit because they're following an old tradition that is part of Chinese society. It's not outside of society, it's part of society, and it's highly respected. It's among the most highly respected things you can do in China is follow a spiritual path. Of course, it takes a lot of guts, and of course, your parents aren't going to be too happy about it. As a result, most of the hermits in China are women. At least 60, maybe 70% of all the people practicing in the mountains are women because it's easier for them to get their parents' permission to follow a path. With the sons are looked on as a family's social security. So you don't just want to just let a son become a monk or a Taoist priest. Going to the mountains, but a girl, that's okay.
Were the demographics different when you first started this work?
No, I would say not in terms of gender distinctions. In 89 and 90 it was 60-70% women, and that's about what I'm seeing. And what I'm really surprised to see though is a monastery, Zen monasteries especially, I'd say 80% women. See, there never were any Zen nunneries in the past at all. And now there are Zen nunneries. Most, until recent times, most of these monasteries had been wiped out. And the ones that sort of came back were Pure Land Buddhist monasteries, where people go to light incense, chant, do some prostrations, but no places that practice meditation. But it's just only recently the Zen monasteries are coming back again. And of course, a number of the significant monasteries for men have come back. What's really surprising is the Zen nunneries. They're just outlandish. Just a number of there's three or four of them with over 1,000 nuns practicing. And another thing that's happening are these lay retreats now that are going on in China. Lay people are becoming really interested in meditation retreats. That never happened before. So of course, a lot of people are just not so enamored of material comforts that they're that they have enough food now. They have a roof over their heads, but they also want to find something more interesting to do with this life than that.
A sense, a lingering sense that there has to be something more. What do you hope that people get out of this film?
Oh, I think so. A couple of laughs, maybe a thought or two of something. Oh, yeah, I could do that too. I don't know what people should get out of it, but I don't think it's a bad film. It's fun. Ward's done a great job mixing the material up so that it's okay. I mean, it's hard for me. See, I'm the subject, and for me to talk about it is sort of weird. It's like looking at myself in the mirror and talking about myself.
What's the funniest part of the film?
The funniest part of the film. Oh, probably the funniest part that was I get a kick out of this is Ward asked me, because of my notoriety in China and the change it's had on my economic well-being, what this has meant for me. And I tell him, well, now I'm drinking $15 wine, $80 bourbon. I was on food stamps my first 18 years back in America and struggling at that just to do anything, just to stay out, not, I was always in credit card debt. Anyway, that was then. Now $15 wine is like no problem.
Maybe the part about you smuggling hashish in your socks.
Well, no, that wasn't that funny. That's a scene in a film. That was sort of a private matter that should have never been in there, really. But filmmakers have their own eyes on what they see as something that accentuates your story.
Did you get patted down a little more in China after
Oh
that?
no! Oh no! No, just the opposite. Usually, when I'm going through, not customs, but the security lines in China, it's not uncommon for me to have to pose with a group picture with the security officials. All it takes is one of them to spot me. And then suddenly, oh, that's so and so. Oh, yeah, I read his book. Oh, hey, how about a picture, Mr. Porter?
How would they say red pine in Chinese?
Well, they don't. Well, if they did, it's Chir Song, Chir Song. But I'm not Red Pine in China. I'm Bill Porter or Beer Porter. See, because I use Red Pine for translation, and see, I'm translating from Chinese into English. So they're not interested in my translations. At least they weren't until last year. Now they want all my translated books. They want the translations along with the original Chinese. There's publishers republishing all my Copper Canyon books now in China. So Chinese can see my translations of the original, because sometimes they have lost a sense of themselves for their own classical language. And my English is so much easier to understand, because any educated person nowadays in China knows quite a bit of English.
Bill, at a time when tensions around the world are very, very high and people are suspicious of the other, and we could provide 10 examples off the top of our head, one move toward peace is getting one culture to know another culture better. And so the work that you're doing is incredible peace work, it's incredible cultural work, and we're a better place having you and your work in it. And I thank you for all that you do.
Well, thank you, Paul. I'm glad that people like it, but I have to do this work regardless. You know how you just find something you love to do, and I think a lot of artists of all genres, whether they're painters or dancers or musicians, I mean, artists are called, and what can you do but to answer the call?
Well said, Bill. What a joy to have you here. I wish you huge success with the movie and with your work in the future.
Thanks a lot, Paul.
Dancing with the Dead, Red Pine, and the Art of Translation, a film by Ward Serrell. It'll be screened April 21st at 2 p.m. at SIFF Cinema Egyptian in Seattle.
Cascadian Profits supporters include Diana Elser, a sponsorship dedicated to her parents, whose practicality, humor, and love of family life reflected their experience in and love for the Missouri Breaks and Ruby Valley, Montana landscapes that define their childhoods. And Steinbrook Native Gallery, located near Pike Place Market in downtown Seattle, featuring fine art of the Northwest Coast from emerging and established artists. A link to their site at cascadianprofits.org.
Cascadian Profits is a project of the Cascadia Poetics Lab in Seattle, Washington. Check us out online at cascadiapoeticslab.org.